Is everybody winded? Exercise? Cardio? Yeah, we should do the hippo cardio workout kind of thing. So our first class is going to be on Noah. Noah. And we won't sing the Arky Arky song again. I think we kind of got the idea. So when we think about Noah, we have our standard images of Noah, right? What are some standard images that we have, or ideas of concepts? Thank you, sir. You're a gentleman and a scholar.
That's right.
What are our general concepts of Noah?
Built an ark.
Huh? He had a gray beard, yes. Which, when he was on the sea, he battled Blackbeard, so it was interesting. Anyway, so he had a gray beard. Flannel Graph has done a number on our concept of Noah, right? Anybody know Flannel Graph? That's right.
What?
He was a just man. So when we think of Noah and we look at Genesis chapter 6 through 9, we have the story of Noah, right? The story of Noah. And we have Genesis is the beginning, the book of beginnings, the book of generations. Do you remember who wrote Genesis? Moses wrote it. Where were they when they were writing this? In the wilderness, in the desert. When they were writing, putting these together. So he wrote the first five books when they were in the desert. And he wrote them for the Israelites as they're coming out of Egypt. Why would they need to know about Noah? Noah, does it help to have a backstory? Have you ever watched a movie and not seen like volume 1 and 2? Have any of you ever started on like Lord of the Rings on like 3? Disc 2? You know, there's some holes right there, right? And there's some serious gaps. Who is Sauron? I don't understand. Ring? I don't know. There's some things that are missing there, right? So when we look at the story of Noah, and we look at the generations that lead up, the book of Genesis begins with in the beginning and ends with, you know, the concept of Joseph and everybody going into Egypt and Joseph saying, when you leave, bring my bones with you. All right, so that's basically the bookends for us in Genesis. And so Genesis gives the Israelite people, gives them the concept of where they came from. Now, a lot of this obviously was probably passed down through oral tradition, so there were things that they kind of knew generally what the story was, but this was the inspired version of where they came from. And we start with mankind, right? Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve starts us off. They were in the garden. We're not sure how long. And then they sort of, you know, messed up, right? Adam throws Eve under the bus, this woman you gave me, right? And, you know, we get the finger pointing coming on. That's called marriage. And so they move on, and we move into what period? They're out of the garden, right? They're out of the garden. They're tilling the soil, doing things for themselves. And when Noah comes on the scene, we're 1,600 years after in the beginning God created. If you count up the genealogies that we have there, 1,600 years. A lot happens in 1,600 years. It's actually 1656. A lot can happen. We've been a nation for how many years? Pop quiz. Mental math, what? 239? Did you say 239? Okay. Almost. We're nigh unto, right? So 239, all right? Has a lot happened in our country in 239 years? Yes, a few things. Now imagine 1,600 years. 1,600 years of history. And these guys were living a long time. And as you look at Genesis chapter 6, what do you open up with? Now it came about in Genesis chapter 6, verse 1. Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, and the sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful or good, and they took wives for themselves and whoever they chose. And then the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his day shall be 120 years. And so God begins to put a timestamp on this. So he says, we got 120 years and things are going to change. 120 years and the flood's going to come is what we're looking at here. Don't read too much into the daughters of men and the sons of God. There's a lot of people who want to read that into that. If we just read the text without our preconceived ideas, we have people who are following God who want to marry people who are not followers of God. That's the simplest explanation of that, okay? So as you read there, it's interesting that he begins to talk about this transition and people falling away from God. And what do we read here is one of the problems is happening. What's one of the problems? What's the issue here? They're falling away because of wickedness. Because the women did it, right? No. But they're unequally yoked is what we'll read in 2 Corinthians, right? 2 Corinthians 6:14. We have they're leading each other away. So here we are moving into what's going on. And look at verse 6. What does verse 6 tell us? The Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Because verse 5 says, then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, verse 5, and that every intent and thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it grieved God that he made man. Eesh. Wouldn't want to be in that situation, right? Yes. So as we look at this text, he was sorry that he made man. The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created. The Creator says to the created, I'm gonna clean you off and we're gonna start over again. But who steps in here and helps us out? Look in verse 8. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was different than the whole world, apparently. Have you ever felt like that before? Am I really the only one that thinks this is wrong? Have you ever been in a situation where you're looking around at what's happening? You're like, am I the only one that thinks this should not be happening right now? You know, and apparently by what's going on, sometimes we've maybe been in small places where that's the case. But Noah literally was like the best there was on the planet. And so here's what's going on with Noah. And so as we give the timestamp on this, Noah is 1,600 years after creation, and everything has just gone downhill, okay? As far as the spirituality and people following after God, they're not following after God. And so God says, I'm going to just clean you off the face of the earth. And he uses water. And he saves Noah by giving them instructions. Now, what are the instructions that are given here? What does God begin to tell Noah? To build an ark. What's an ark?
A boat.
There are two arks in the Bible. What's the other ark? And it is a what? It's a boat! It's a what? It's a box. So an ark is what? A box. Who said it was a boat? We did. We said it was a boat, right? Because it floats. It's got to be a boat. It's a boat. You know, we kind of read into the text what this is. God told Noah, build a box. Build a box. Now, obviously, it starts to float, and it's a boat, right? It's a boat, okay, you know. But when we look at those flannel graph pictures, those nice rounded edges, and they got the keel and everything, which, have you noticed, the keel on that thing is huge. Where'd they find a tree for that thing? It's huge. What are the dimensions that we, as we look at the text in chapter 6, what are the dimensions that we have for this thing? Cubits. Anybody used a cubit? Hey, can I borrow your cubit ruler here? Do we use cubits? No, we don't. What are cubits? Anybody have in your text what a cubit is? 45 centimeters or 18 inches is the standard, and that's typically, in the picture there, that's typically elbow to the tip of your finger, right? Now, there's actually some description about that. So Noah was trained where when he was growing up as a boy? Or not Noah, I'm sorry, Moses. Moses, the author of this, in Egypt. There are some people who are saying, well, the Egyptian cubit was 22 and a half inches. And there's some saying, well, the Syrian one is 15 inches. And so there's no standardization, right? I would like some standardization in the Bible, but hey, you know, what can we do? So we take 18 inches as a general accepted general halfway point. And so we take 18 inches and we think about the size of the ark. We're looking at 450 feet for its length. Just to give you an idea, and David knew this, I'm not sure why he knew this, but he knew this, that the entrance over here, all the way to the end of the, where the pavement is, or over the grass, is about 450 feet. It's about how long that is. For the property, yes, for the property over here where you come in, where you have the nice signs and everything, from that entrance there all the way over to the canal, where the pavement ends, is about 450 feet. Now, if you start using your that's a big box, right? And how tall is it? It's 45 feet high and 75 feet wide. That is a big box. Now, is it just a box? What else is going on with this image here? Three decks, three layers. What else do we have going on structurally with the ark? A window. It says window, right? But what does the text say there about the window? What does it say about the window? Let's pick this apart. Yep. 16. You shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit from the top and set the door of the ark in the side of it. And you shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. So the concept is that possibly it's just a big ventilation window all the way around the top. Which, if you have that many animals in one place, would be a good thing, right? That would be a very good thing. I know if I had just a few teenagers in something like that, I would want something like that. They're not in here. Yeah, okay. So that's good. Ventilation is very good, all right? Now, think about the concept of a boat. In this case, a box. Where are you going to put that door? Where's that door? When you see the flannel graph, it's kind of halfway down, close, and you just got a little ramp and get in there. But when that thing gets, when the waters come up high, where's the water line going to be? Typically, on a barge, it's at least halfway up if it's full. Okay, so that door's got to be up on the top so that we, you know, just conceptualize, that's where the door should probably be structurally if we're designing this thing. It's going to be on the side, okay? So just think through the details of this. Now, with these dimensions, which, by the way, these are dimensions that are generally understood as like the dimension for something to float. Maritime rules say that this is the basic dimensions for something to be able to float, which is pretty cool. Okay, this was Moses. He wasn't exactly a shipwright whenever he was writing this thing. Okay, so it was obviously another little tidbit of inspiration there. And so these are dimensions that are still used today. Based on those dimensions, we're talking about as far as the amount of space that was there, the amount of space. This may kind of hold on to your seats. 520 train cars is equivalent to what the ark was able to hold. 520 train cars. That's a few train cars. Like the standard box car is what we're talking about. Exactly, which is what I was thinking. You know, that's like 52 10-car trains. And I'm talking about the high eights, not the big ones, but the standardized the box cars is what we're talking about as they go by. 520. I would lose my mind. You would learn, you'd memorize graffiti tats on the side of those things. Like, I've seen that guy. All right. So you know, anyway, so as they go by, 520, that is a lot of space. Now, what had to go into this thing? What had to go into this? A lot of animals. Was it just two of every kind? The Lord said, no. Well, seven of what? Let's read the text. What does it say? Seven pairs of the clean ones. Which, where do we read about clean animals? Clean and unclean. Leviticus, Exodus, we start reading. And so apparently they understood what clean animals were. So they were animals that they would use and sacrifice to God. Even then, God said, there were certain animals I want sacrificed. Not just any old animal. Okay, and so the clean ones, there had to be seven of each, male and female, as they go in. Okay, obviously because they're going to be sacrificed, and they want them to reproduce a little bit faster than the others. Okay, so that makes sense. And so we have them coming into the ark, and God gives Noah all these instructions. All right, and of every living thing, of all the flesh, you shall bring two of every kind, verse 19, and keep them alive with you, and you shall be male and female, with the birds of the air and the creeping thing and the ground of water, after its kind, two of every kind. And you get down, and he goes through. And in verse 21, as for you, take for yourself some of all food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them. Who's the them? Are you kidding me? Couldn't they do like a Daniel thing and just kind of shut their mouths for a while, you know, for that would be convenient. Then you wouldn't have to do all that tonnage as far as the food that's in there, okay? So food for you and them. Verse 22 is probably a huge summary. Verse 22, what does verse 22 say of chapter 6? And he did it. And then verse 7 says what? Or chapter 7, then the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark. Wait a second. All that instruction, all that stuff you have to do, and then we get one verse, and he did it. And then chapter 7, and Noah and God told Noah to enter the ark. Whoa, wait a second. How long did it take him to do that? Well, we got the timestamp of 120 years. God said, hey, I got 120 years, and things are going to get wet in 120 years, okay? But how do we know about roughly timestamp? We have that. That may be it. But what about age? Is his age ever mentioned? Verse 32 of chapter 5 says what? 500 years old, right? When Shem, Ham, and Japheth were born. Were they twins? I don't know. Triplets, yeah, sorry, that one. Apparently, I don't know much, but anyway, so they may have been triplets. We don't know. But look at, how old was Noah in verse 6 of chapter 7 when he entered the ark? 600. So at least 100 years, right? At least 100 years, maybe more. So have you ever done anything for 100 years? I'm not going to ask if you've ever done anything, or it seemed like it was 100 years, right? If we dedicated 10 years of our life to something, that would be huge, right? Monumental. If we dedicated 10 years to something. So he dedicates 100 years at least to building this ark. Now you think through from wood, a forest, to finished product, what he had to do. And there's no Lowe's, there's no Home Depot, all right? There's none of that kind of stuff. Just think through the process. What is he going to have to do? What are some first things he's going to have to do? He's going to cut down some trees. You may want to draw it out, right? If you're going to build a box, I might start drawing it out. Start staking out where we're going to do this thing, right? So you got to cut down trees and maybe even have to clear a place to do it. You're going to have to build up some foundations to actually build the thing on, because you're not going to build it straight on the ground. Have you put wood for 100 years on the dirt? What happens? Begins to rot. So he's actually building something that if he doesn't build it and pitch it, it could rot while he's building it. It begins to be mind-boggling, the thing that he did. We have one verse as far as like how much involvement we have as far as explanation of him doing it. We know that it was made out of what kind of wood? Gopher wood. And we know that he had to do what with the gopher wood as far as treating it? Had to pitch it inside and out. Pitch you actually make from tree bark, or from certain types of tree bark. You can make it from birch. I don't know that he's going out and collecting sap necessarily, but there's ways of making this. What kind of tools was he using? Hammer. I want a hammer. Wouldn't you want a hammer? Yeah. Did you know the Bible says a little bit about metallurgy? Look in Genesis chapter 4, verse 22. Genesis chapter 4, verse 22. It's interesting what you can read or what you can learn as you read through genealogies. What's mentioned there about metallurgy in verse 22? I'm sorry? Bronze and iron. Tubal-Cain, the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. Wait a second. You mean this wasn't the Stone Age? And then the Bronze Age? And then the Iron Age? Where have you heard that before? from school, right? How many of you had to learn about the Stone Age and the Bronze Age and the Iron Age? Any of you? Nobody had to learn that? One of us? Okay. Ish. I've deleted that information, so I don't even remember if I had to learn that or not. You know, that premise is based on the idea that everything kind of happened and evolved in the same fluid motion, and everything kind of happened. And so as you read the story of Noah, we're thinking, you know, they're using obsidian or something like that, if that's the... But the Bible tells us, before the flood, during those 1,600 years, they had bronze and they had iron. Where would you get those things? Huh? They had craftsmen to do that, right? He would probably go to somebody to buy these things. The odds are he's not actually doing these things, because it takes a lot just to do this. But you have to have people that are mining the ore for the iron. And bronze is an alloy of copper and zinc, right? And so you have to have those two things. Then you have to have somebody that works with those. Are you starting to see the picture of the infrastructure that has to be in place for him to actually do this project? And we have one verse there, and he did it. But can you imagine the day-to-day of him actually doing this? Now, how do you lift a beam? Crane would be nice. That would be awesome. That would be a lot of iron to make a crane. You have to have pulley system. Leverage, tackle, and block, right? Yes, sir. Exactly. I mean, there's ways of doing this, guys. There's ways of doing this. Go ahead. Well, I was about to say, actually, that's all kidding aside, guys. It doesn't say this, okay? It doesn't say that he went all Barney Rubble on this, okay? But he did have large beasts of burden. They did have large beasts of burden. And we do have evidence in stone of man and animal, or man and dinosaur walking together. We have evidence of that, okay? And so it's not too far-fetched to think about that. Yes, ma'am? They were strong people. He may have hired out some labor, day labor. He went down to, you know, we don't know exactly how he did this. You know, there were some. They were may have been stronger. They lived longer, so they could go to the gym longer than we could, maybe. But
how the pyramids were built? You saw the people.
Well, that's another story. That's aliens involved. That one, obviously. But we got to really think about. We really got to think about this concept. These were not unintelligent people that God asked to do these things. And as you look at 1,600 years of history, there's a lot of time to learn things and know things. Job is actually one of the oldest documents that we have in the Bible. And Job, when we read chapter 28 of Job, it talks about tunneling underneath the mountains. Tunneling underneath the mountains and finding copper and iron ore and how hot it is down there. Job. That's a long time ago. And that completely throws off our concept of, you know, Stone Age knuckle draggers. See what I'm saying? We think we are just the smartest people that have ever lived. And that may be true. But how many times have you tried to forge anything? You want to trade smarts for smarts. It depends on where you're living, right? But I wanted to focus on that just to let us know that this is a huge undertaking, a huge deal. And Noah did it. Noah did it. Now, I realize that Moses is probably trying to, you know, do the short Cliff Notes version of 1,600 years of history, okay? He doesn't have all that time. But he shows us an image of a faithful man and his family working on this. They're working on this together. And in chapter 7, they begin to enter the ark, okay? And God tells them to enter the ark, and Noah was 600 years when they entered the ark, and the flood water came upon the earth, and Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives and him entered the ark, in verse 7, because of the water of the flood. Of clean animals, it goes into this again. And they enter in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month of the seventh day of the month, on the day all the fountains of the great of the deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky opened, and the rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. How long was Noah in and his family in this box? I'm sorry? A little over a year. A little over a year. Now, it just rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Okay? It just rained that long. But they're in this box with all these animals, and they were just thanking God for that little window up there, right? For over a year. If you read, look in, skip over, maybe it's one page for me. Verse 14 of chapter 8. And the second month and the 27th day of the month of the year was dry. The land was dry, okay? And it was the 601st year, verse 13, the life of Noah. And so they were in there a while. And so our flannel graph image of this event begins to take more life. And we can start putting ourselves in that position, in that situation. And Noah did the work. And Noah did the work. So they come out, and the story, as the story goes, there are several birds that are sent out to see kind of what's going on with the dry land of what's happening. Do you remember how deep it got at the end of chapter 7? I'm sorry, you're saying it? 15 cubits above the highest point, which is about the halfway mark on the boat, right? Basically, that's saying we didn't drag bottom the whole time we were floating around. Could you imagine? I imagine Noah being in a valley making this thing and looking up and seeing mountains and things around. That's just my imagination, okay? That's not in the text, but that's my imagination of where he is. And then he opens up to see what's outside, and he sees water as far as he can see. Have you ever been out in the water and it's all you see as far as all the way around you? That's sort of eerie a little bit. Now imagine that you're the only people on the planet. Does that make it even a little more real? So when things begin to dry out and the ark rests on mountains of Ararat and things kind of begin to recede, and they're able to come out of the ark, where's all that infrastructure that was there before? It's gone. All that infrastructure, as far as other people knowing these trades and trading and that kind of stuff, that's all gone. A lot of knowledge was lost. What only knowledge is there was what Noah retained and his sons. And so they begin to plant, and they begin. And it's interesting here in chapter 9, as all this begins to take place, what happens, what does God tell to Noah? Be fruitful and multiply, right? And he begins to plant and to do that very thing. But a promise is made. A promise is made. What kind of promise is made? I'll never destroy the world again by water. And what does God actually say here in verse 9, or chapter 9, verse 1? And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. The fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast. Now, they've been with these animals for a year feeding them. They might have had a relationship with these animals. And now he's saying they're going to be afraid of you. You're not going to have that anymore. Again, that's an assumption on my part, but if you're around an animal feeding it for a year, you might create a relationship with it. They might have names now, you know. They might be pets. For some children, they'd be pets. Vivian names every fish we catch sometimes. So they might have names, all right? Yeah. Yes, and so God put that fear in them to get them out there and not be hovering around the ark anymore. So that becomes part of what changes for them. And so this promise is made. And he says, with everything that creeps on the ground, all flesh will see into your... So that's every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you, verse 3. I find that interesting because that's the first time we actually read of them eating meat. And I don't want to make a big deal about this. because in Genesis, when earlier in Genesis, we're told that they're eating, you know, they eat of the plant and that kind of stuff. But this is the first instruction that they're actually eating meat. Now, we know they have sacrificed, Abel sacrificed, but that's just an interesting thing that makes you go, hum. Can't really read into that too much, but just makes you go, didn't think about that. God says, now you can eat them. Go chase them. They're running away, go chase them. So here's just the image, and then God begins to tell them there's a rainbow going to be in the sky. And what does that rainbow mean? It's a sign. Now remember, before, how was everything watered? They didn't have rain before, right? They didn't have rain. The waters came up in a mist. And so now he's saying that this, and we understand what happens. Why is a rainbow made? Teachers, scientists, anybody? What happens? Refraction, yes. And we have the scientific definition over here that sunlight goes through raindrops, which creates refraction, and you have, yes. So I think it's interesting that as Noah sees rain clouds coming, he might be thinking, oh no, here we go again, right? You know, he might have a little nervous twitch from experience on the boat. But there's a rainbow that says, nope, no, this is not a flood thing. This is not going to be like that again, okay? It's there. That's how nature, that's how science, you know, tells us what that's there. But God made it for us as a sign. Now, people have taken it and used the rainbow for many, many things, but it was God's first. And it was God's promise to us that what he says is faithful. So for these thousands of years since Noah, it hasn't rained. It hasn't rained, and we've been living in a drought. It hasn't flooded the earth. It hasn't flooded the earth. God's promised and has been faithful in these things. Now, I find it interesting also in the timestamp on this, 1,656 years after God said in the beginning, and then it's from Noah on, it's like 2,500, I can't remember the exact date, 2,500 years to Christ. So that's a big chunk of history, human history, world history, summed up in 9 chapters, right? It's a big chunk of history. So as we look at this, God really, I mean, he had been with them for that long and said, I'm done. Let's look at the New Testament and see what the New Testament says for us about Noah. There's some verses in the New Testament that give us some lessons that we can learn from Noah. Hebrews chapter 11 is probably one of the most famous concerning him. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 7. What is Hebrews chapter 11? Talks a lot about what? Faith, yes. Talks a lot about faith. Okay. Hebrews is, this chapter is pretty neat history-wise also. So we have Enoch. And then in chapter verse 7, it says, by faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen. What had he not yet seen before? Rain. Being warned about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. Now, what happened after the flood to the lineage of human race? The human race tree kind of went down to this, right? It got really narrow there with Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and then it started branching out again. And so we went from Adam, ballooned out, and then went, whoop, down to Noah, and then Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then Genesis begins to tell us to track Shem and see how the Israelites came through Shem and went into Egyptian bondage. And so again, we're tracking lineage through generations through the book of Genesis. And so as we look at Hebrews, we see a man of what? Faith. Did he just believe? Well, I believe what God says is true. He believed and obeyed. That's interesting. Is that combination important when it comes to faith? If you read through chapter 11 of Hebrews, you have faith and verb, right? By faith, verb. By faith, person, verb is kind of what you have throughout the chapter 11, okay? And We see the verb in Genesis chapter 6, verse 22, and Noah did all that the Lord commanded. And then we talked about everything he did. So as every time he's chopping down a tree by faith, he's splitting that tree by faith because he knows that God, what God said happened. That was his day-to-day life. And not just building that, he also had to, you know, they had to farm or whatever they had to do to keep maintain themselves also. And so his day-to-day life, every action was an action of faith. Is there any kind of application to that to us today? Maybe a little bit? A big bit. By faith, I'm living a different life than those who are around me. I'm going to ask a couple of questions here. I'm not trying to be pointed at all, but where was the youth group for Shem, Ham, and Japheth? In the ark with the animals. They were the weird kids. They were probably homeschooled. I was homeschooled, by the way, so I can say that. Just through high school, though, so I'm a little bit normal. So as we look at their lives, where was their youth group? In each other. The family became an integral part. Shem, Ham, and Japheth could literally say, everybody else is doing it. They were the only ones in history that could literally say, well, everybody else is doing this. And you know what Noah could say? Well, they're going to drown. How well can they tread water, right? So what are we looking at here? We're looking at a family that is a solid family unit. And it was them against the world, literally them against the world, and God had their back. Parents, when it gets hard, this should be part of the verbiage of your family. It's us and them. It's us and them. We don't roll like they do. We don't act like they do. Well, I'm going to be different, and you better be different. You better be different. Now, that's faith. In action, because you're going to have your kids are going to fight battles. Sending them to school. They're going to have to fight battles, spiritual battles over their souls. And there's some, and today it seems like they're fighting these battles a lot younger than they need to be. But they're not going to be prepared if we're not preparing them. And if they're not seeing you fight those battles. They've got to see if it's important to my family, if it's important to my mom, if it's important to my dad, and they've got to see it when they're young, it'll be important to them. Not all the time, because kids, you know, kids, they mess up. You can't expect perfection out of them. Because how many of you are perfect in your youth? Even David said, forgive the sins of my youth, right? We've been there, okay? But we need to help them through those things. What are some other lessons we can learn from Noah? We got faith. We have action. Look in 2 Peter chapter 2. Verses 3 through 6. Let's begin in verse 4. For God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell. And again, we're not going to go into that. That's another class, okay? So just don't ask questions about the angels and casting into hell right now. Commended them to the pits of darkness reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a preacher of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. And if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example of those who would live ungodly lives thereafter, and he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. And the Lord knows
then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from what? From temptation, and to keep the righteous under unrighteous under punishment the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge in the flesh and its corrupt desires and despise authority.
So what do we learn from those examples? Those are some dark days in human history, right? Those are some dark days. This is where God said no and killed everybody because there was nothing left that was good. Even Abraham in that time says, even if there's like 10, God, would you save him if there's 10? And he's like, no, there's not. There's not. There's not any. And he tried to save him. He tried to barter with God in that way. But there wasn't. But what does this verse tell us in verse 9? Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation. There is a way out. There is a way out. In the moment, Satan doesn't want us to feel like there's a way out, right? In the case of Lot, when you read the story of Lot, the angels basically had to drag him out almost, right? They physically laid on of hands and took him out of the city. Did they save his wife? No, she turned back, right? Turned in pillar of salt.
They did, but she didn't.
But she did, yeah. She didn't obey. Now, his daughters were morally gone. From what they did with him in that cave. So Lot pretty much was all that was left. So we need to be careful with our influences, right? Be careful with where we're going to be living. Be careful with our influences and what we let into our families. But here's the situation. God knows how to rescue the godly. If you want out, there's a way out. But you've got to take that action. The door's open, you've got to walk through it. God knows how to rescue those people. Look over in Matthew chapter 24. Another lesson we can learn about from Noah. By the way, this is not really meant to be a lecture. So if you have questions and comments that are relevant to the class, you're more than welcome to make them. Matthew 24, 37 and 38. What do you have here as your chapter heading for this chapter? Now remember, chapter headings are not inspired, okay? What do you have?
No one knows the day or the hour.
That's the chapter heading for yours?
Jesus predicts the destruction of the
temple. Okay. I have mine here, and mine says signs of Christ's return. I know, right? I don't know. This was actually, never mind, I'm not going to go into that. Anyway, New American Standard has on here signs of Christ's return. Hey, no, it's perfect. So as we look at this, some of your chapter's heading may have something like that. As we go through this, the apostles ask questions, because he talks about the destruction of the temple, right? And in the apostles' and the disciples' minds, that could only happen at the end of the earth. That's the only thing that can destroy the temple. Because what we have left right now are just some foundation blocks. The temple's gone. Okay, and then in AD 70, Rome came in and said, no, we're done with you guys, and just destroyed, razed that thing. Not like raised it up in the sky, but with a Z, and just took it away, okay? And so as we look at this, they're thinking that can only happen with the end of the earth. And so they're thinking those coincide. We begin in verse 36, and talking about these things. He says, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, talking about the destruction of the world, not even angels in the heaven or the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man, which is Christ, will be just like the days of Noah. Wait a second. Just like the days of Noah? What does it say? For as in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. And so will the coming of the Son of Man be. What else do we learn about from Noah? From that example, according to this text?
He was prepared.
He was prepared. And not everybody else was. Yes, sir. There is that type, an anti-type concept, if you're familiar with that concept. He said he was a savior like Christ. Anybody ever use a typewriter before? I played on one. I was like, this is fun. And then went back to using a computer. But what a type and an anti-type, you know, you have that letter that kind of comes over, goes, burr, hits that tape, and then, you know, you have the letter on the other side. So it's the same kind of concept. Want some images in the Bible. You have Moses was an anti-type of the Christ, right? And we're going to read here in just a second. You're getting ahead of us in our lesson. And we're going to look at about that concept. But Julie, you had your hand up? Exactly. Exactly. There's not going to be, you know, and a lot of the premillennial people like to get into this concept where there's going to be signs, and the Russians are going to do this, and the Chinese are going to do this, and the Koreans are going to do this, and then we'll know that, you know, this is what's going to happen. I'm sorry, that's not in the text. You have to read that into the text, okay? Just like we have to read into the text that the ark is a boat, you have to read into the text that those kind of things are actually there. You had a comment?
I was just thinking that those in Noah's time that were evil didn't believe him.
Exactly. Yes.
And it's going to be that way when Christ comes again. Those that don't believe, when they hear the trumpet sound, it's too late.
Yes. And the text here, as it reads, what are they doing here? Well, as was mentioned, Jerry was saying that it's going to be too late. Okay, they're not going to believe, and then it's just going to be too late. You're not going to be able to repent when Jesus comes. You can't say, "Oh, I'm just kidding." You know, you can't do that. Then it's too late at that point. But the text tells us that they were doing what? Eating and drinking, giving in marriage. So they're making plans, right? When you're getting married, you're making sort of some lifelong plans, all right? And so that's what is saying is going to happen when Christ comes again. There's not going to be any sort of message in the sky. Christ's coming, you might want to change your life. Who's that message? Christ was that message, right? His church should be that message. Change your life. Repent. Christ is coming. The kingdom's here, right? That should be our message. What does the text tell us? That Noah was a preacher of righteousness. A preacher of righteousness. How many people did he convert? None. Yeah. And now, if you sent a missionary out and only his family came back, you're like, dude, we want some return on our investment here, right? How many souls were saved? Eight. It's not very good turnover investment. And sometimes, you know, that's another lesson. Sorry, not going to go into that. But as we look at this, and we learn some lessons from Noah, it's going to come swift. The judgment of God is going to come swift, and we're not going to know when it's going to happen. So we need to be prepared. And so the question is, what are you doing right now to prepare for your family? What are you doing right now? That's an interesting ringtone, actually. What are you doing right now to prepare for your family? Yes.
Bring the gospel to them.
That's right. We need to bring the gospel to them. Look over in 1 Peter chapter 3. First Peter chapter 3, verses 20 and 21. And again, this is that what you were saying before, that type and anti-type imagery here. 1 Peter chapter 3. Who were once disobedient, talking about the people who were disobedient before, who were once disobedient when the patience of God, when waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water. Okay, so, and this is another concept we may not get. God's waiting for the punishment. If God really wanted it to happen, he could have just said, "Zap! You have a box." You know. I find that interesting. God was patiently waiting while He was making that. Now, of course, the time frame—God for a day, for us—so it's not the same. But He allowed Noah to take that time to build that ark.
He's preaching at the same time.
Don't know what he's saying. A giant box What are you doing? It's going to rain. It's going to what? We don't even know what that is, right? Is that too far off when we preach the gospel to people? You mean we're going to go where? You want me to do what? I have to get wet? I don't understand. You see the similarities that are there? Preacher of righteousness. And what is the example here that we have in verse 21? They were saved, brought safely through water. Corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh, not just washing your physical body, but an appeal to God for good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So Jesus Christ's resurrection, I'm going to be a part of that through baptism. Just like Noah was saved and his family were brought safely through water, I can be brought through that water through the grave of baptism. You see the similarities that are there. So what do we learn from Noah? Righteousness, faith, obedient faith, the day-to-day. This is a day-to-day grind kind of faith. This isn't the faith and you have those, yay, Bible camp faith. This is what? The constant grinding, going through the day-to-day faith is what we learn about with Noah. 100 years at least he's building this thing. Cutting down trees. He probably had a few calluses. What are calluses? I don't even know what those are. I know.
Imagine he started close when he started felling the trees.
Yes.
100 years later, those trees are pretty far out.
Yes, he's got a nice little valley, kind of cleared out for him. But that's Noah. That's faith. That's day-to-day faith. I can relate to that because there are times when my faith, I've got to just push through, right? I've got to be obedient and just do it. Do you think there was ever a time when Noah ever said, I don't feel like it? I hear that. We hear that a lot nowadays, right? Well, I just don't feel it. Not feeling it. Not feeling it. Not going to do it. Does that work? That's not. There are times when you just have to do it. It doesn't matter if you're not feeling it or not. Just do it because we have to be obedient. So we learn about faith. We learn about the day-to-day, daily grind faith. We learn about the concept of being saved through water. And we learn about judgment's going to come swift and with no sign. And you better have your boat ready. Be prepared. Heaven is a prepared place for a prepared people. And the question is, are you prepared? Are you prepared? How's your family? Do you have your food together? Are your animals together? See what I'm saying? There's some things we need to do to get ready for that. Any questions, comments, or anything before we finish? Yes?
God don't have pity on you.
I'm sorry?
God don't have pity on you. He's going to have pity on the unrighteous.
Exactly. His pity is right now. He's given us time to make a decision. God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. All right, if you don't have any more questions, let's finish this class with a prayer.